Our guest today is one of the BBC's best-loved radio presenters with a career at the BBC spanning 35 years. Simon Mayo has worked on BBC Radio 1, 5 Live these days, has millions of listeners in the Radio 2 drive time slot. He's also been turning his hand to writing fiction. His fourth book, Blame, is his first aimed at the young adult market. He's with us this morning. Mr. Mayo, good morning to you.
Mr. Nolan.
Good morning.
Yes. I'm not sure I can follow that exchange that you just played me down there.
Oh, it's a typical morning on a Nolan show, Simon.
Okay.
It is. The basis of the book is the idea of heritage crime, isn't it? Explain that to us.
Yes. Yeah, so heritage crime is the central idea behind the book. And the idea is that it's a few years away from now. We're a few years into the future. The EU has collapsed. There's been a very bad recession, and society in general in this country and many other countries are looking for people to scapegoat. They are looking to people to blame, hence the title of the book. And heritage crime is defined in the book as when you are being held responsible for crimes committed by your parents or grandparents. So it's a kind of sins of the fathers idea. And it came from...
A dream?
Now you might be somewhat skeptical about this, as any decent interviewer would be. If someone comes on and says, yes, it came to me in a dream. Yeah, sure it did. Yeah. Okay. So I'd written a piece for Michael Morpurgo's book. He'd written a book about, called Only Remembered, about, it was sort of reminiscences about the First World War. It came out in 2014. And he wrote to me, or his editor did, you know, pretending to be him, saying, do you have any connection with the First World War? And if so, you know, if any of your family fought, do you have anything you could write for this book? And I said, well, I had a great uncle who died in 1916, and I could find out a bit about him. His name was Lieutenant Stanley Killingback, and I knew that my grandmother had a picture of him on her mantelpiece and would always put her poppy next to his photograph. And I thought, well, you know, I know he died in the First World War, I'll find out. So I did some research, I got the photograph, I attached it with a song, and because it was for Michael Morpurgo, I did my best work, Stephen. You know, it's like you want to impress teacher. And because he is this extraordinary hero, really, I thought I would do my best. So I wrote this piece about my great uncle and sent it in. And then I really didn't think I was going to hear any more about it until the book came out. And then that night I had a dream, Stephen. Trust me on this. And in the dream I was going to prison because it had been discovered that my great uncle was in fact a deserter, which he wasn't. But in my dream he was. And because he had got away with his crime, I had to pay the price. And everyone else in the queue going into Pentonville Prison in London was in a similar situation. They were all going in to pay for crimes committed by other people. And so I thought, well, it was an interesting, you know, and it was a very haunting image, and it stayed with me for quite a while. But if I was going to make it the central legal idea behind my book, then I had to make it work and I had to make it believable. So I ended up having a fascinating breakfast with Charlie Falconer, Lord Falconer, who was Lord Chancellor under Tony Blair for many years.
You mixed with some interesting people for breakfast.
Well, it took some arranging.
Yeah.
I have to say he spent our 1 hour together. I think he got through 3 Diet Cokes and 4 apples, which is kind of his diet these days. Anyway, in the course of it, he said, Simon, heritage crime is not that far-fetched. And in many states in America, because he's an expert on American law as well, they're moving in this direction anyway. And then he said, and this was kind of like, because I wanted to have a construct where you could imagine a disreputable politician going on Question Time on the television, talking about heritage crime and getting a round of applause from the audience. So he said, you have to understand, Simon, that many people would suggest that slavery was a heritage crime, that the banks and corporations that hundreds of years ago did very well out of slavery still owe a debt to those communities who suffered and are still suffering. And so all of a sudden it became a construct. I think, okay, I can now imagine a politician coming on a show such as yours or going on the television and basically using it as a bully pulpit, using it to do a rabble-rousing speech and people thinking, you know what, maybe these people do owe us a debt. Maybe they should go to prison. And so that was the kind of background into which I've written a thriller about a 16-year-old girl.
And was this dream so scary for you that you remembered it? You know, when you're waking up some days and things are... you remember the detail because it had frightened you in your sleep.
Yeah, well, I've had two dreams, I think, that I can remember all my life. But when I woke up, the image was so strong, and I can still see it now. I can still imagine.
What are you seeing?
I'm seeing about six or seven people in the queue. Pentonville Prison, I drive past on a regular basis. It's on the Caledonian Road in London, and it's a pretty terrifying building. You know, it's. I imagine it'll be due for closure at some stage, like Holloway Prison has been done further up the road. And it's a pretty desperate place, and we were a pretty desperate queue alongside an old brick wall, and we were just chatting. And the other thing I remember is that we weren't surprised that this, you know, we knew that this was coming to us. We knew that this was a debt that we had to, we weren't kind of rebelling or being angry about it, as the characters are in my book, but we were just going on because we knew that this was what society expected, so which was almost as scary as the fact we were going in the first place.
You also very much tap into, I guess, the issue of punishing the most vulnerable. There's a theme there as well. What's that about in your head?
I think it's based on, we have over hundreds of years always blamed groups in society, sections in society, because we don't want to analyse what might have been our fault in the first place. And historically, I mean, we can all fill in the blanks, but historically that could be refugees, it could be Jews, it could be black people, it could be immigrants, it could be whoever you want. And we lash out and we don't understand and we don't try and explain, so we point the finger. So I've just taken it to the, you know, we've kind of run out of people. In my book, we've run out of people to blame. And so, led by some elements in the press and some journalists and some bloggers, the finger is being pointed at heritage criminals, those people who are, in quotes, they've got away with it over the years. They've lived quite a good life while everyone else has suffered. And so people are thinking, well, no, actually, you need to suffer as well. And so it's a fairly punitive world that blame takes place in. But the only country that is resistant to this is Germany. And Germany, for its history, has said, we're having nothing to do with heritage crime. And so the resistance to heritage crime comes from groups of people who increasingly speak German. And so there's a German slang through the book because people think, well, if we're going to get away from this, we need to escape to Germany.
And your son, Simon Ben, said that you had based the baddie in the book on Michael Gove.
Well,
is any of this true?
No, what? Okay, so it does read like that now, but because Michael Gove, obviously, when he was Justice Minister, he was a prison reformer, as is the main bad guy. The main bad guy in my book is a bloke called Assessor Gray, and he's a kind of Cromwellian Puritan. He has a Scottish brogue, he has thick glasses, he has slick back hair, and reading it now, he does come over as a little bit Michael Gove. This is true.
What is a little bit Michael Gove?
A little bit Michael Gove, well, the physical similarity is the first thing. The kind of the prison reformer is the second thing. And the third thing is kind of the eyes of a zealot. And people will react to a zealot in a number of different ways, but that's who I'm seeing.
Is it not scary to write a book?
Scary to write a book or any book or this book in particular?
Any book.
Well, it is in as much as it's the very opposite of what we are doing now. So if you do a daily radio show, you think, when this show is finished, you're saying, fine, okay, that's it, what's next? And then when you've done the next show, you think, okay, what's next? And you move on and you move on and you move on. And that's the thrill of radio. You can think, you know, you can wake up thinking of an idea and then you can do it within a couple of hours and you get your team and you work on it and it's very fast. Writing a book is the exact opposite of this. This has taken about 3 years to write. As a consequence, it's a very visceral experience. So the main characters in the book are a brother and sister. She is called Ant and she's 16. And he is called Matty and he's 11. And they are in prison because in my book we're locking up families, and they live in Spike, which is the kind of family annex of the prison. And as a result of this, to answer your question, the aunt is a very damaged but extraordinary person. And because of writing about her for 3 years, and you might hear writers say this kind of nonsense on a regular basis, but she kind of becomes real in your head. And so you, in a way that, so radio is very immediate and writing a book is a very long, lonely process. And so, yes, it is pretty scary because once it's out there, you feel very attached and very alone, really, and you just hope people like the stuff that you've done.
I'm making a film in the minute for television with Annie McGuire and Patrick McGuire, who were wrongfully accused. Very well-known story. And Patrick, it just strikes me from what you're talking about, you know, a youngster in prison. Patrick was 13, Simon, when he was arrested in Northern Ireland, and he was put into prison, 13 and a half. He was in jail. And I've spoken to him some now, just a couple of weeks ago, for a telly project, some 40-odd years later, and he is so damaged, he is so wrecked by it. And the damage that prison can do to an individual is just what's front and foremost in my mind as you're speaking to me this morning.
Yeah,
Mark,
well,
can wreck someone.
Yeah, but there is a large section in society that believes in prison, rightly or wrongly. Michael Howard once said prison works, and many people would agree with him. So what I've done now is I've gone back to a lot of the imagery in the book is Victorian. So the family annex I've called Spike, which is from the workhouse. And in Victorian times, we locked up families and there were debtors' prisons. And so I hear exactly what you're saying. And so the central, the most terrifying idea is this idea that we are prepared in the future to lock up families. So Ant and Matty are in prison with their foster parents. And of course, if you're locked, I mean, my story sounds peripheral and silly next to yours, which is true and has happened. But I, having written about it purely as a work of fiction, I can only imagine the complete horror of a 13-and-a-half-year-old who is locked up, which is, of course, not supposed to happen.
I don't read a lot of books because I read a lot of newspapers and a lot of copy for my job. And I, you know, my friends often tell me that it's a tragedy that I don't read more.
That's the wrong way around, Stephen. It's completely the wrong way around.
Yeah, and that's what they tell me too. Yeah.
I mean, I think I had a friend many years ago who had this phrase, the tyranny of newsprint, which, and every time I read a newspaper, you read a newspaper and you pick it up because, you know, in a few hours it's going to be out of date. You have to read it now. Read this now. Read this now. Read this now. But you never get to the end of a newspaper and think, oh, okay, I feel better about the world. In fact, completely the opposite. But if you choose the right books, Stephen, you know, I think you should read more books because if you choose right, you know, you're thinking, wow, I'm going to go back and read that again.
So for those people listening to this, that some of whom will never have read a book in their life, what is the pleasure of reading a book?
I think if you pick the right book for you, it's the most intense personal experience that you can have. It's a bit like when you're 14 and you fall in love for the first time, maybe with another person, or maybe with a band. You know, maybe you suddenly hear the music that you love more than anything else, and that will stay with you for the rest of your life. It's that kind of harmonious response that you get from something that speaks to you. So that if you find the right book, if you find the right author, if you find the right genre, when you disappear into that world, it takes you somewhere which a movie can't do, which a piece of music can't do, which a radio television program can't do, and it's yours and it's very personal. You read it when you choose, and you can write on the book if you want. You know, you can scribble on it, you can write your own comments, but equally it can be horrible and you can chuck the book away, and you know, but you have to get the right one.
What's your favorite and why? Nothing you've written yourself?
No, obviously. You think I'd actually been. I remember Art Garfunkel going on Desert Island Discs or the Radio 1 equivalent, which I think was called My Top 12, and almost all the tracks he chose were his own. And he thought, oh dear, you, Art, you haven't really thought about this. I think my favourite books of the last few years...
No, your favourite book ever.
Okay.
Is there one?
Well, I'm going to give the same answer, Stephen.
Okay.
It's a trilogy. Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy, which started with Northern Lights, and then The Subtle Knife, which was the second one, which was my favourite, and then Amber Spyglass. I think I've never read a book with greater imagination and depth of understanding and extraordinary philosophy going on behind it. Philip Pullman's mind, an amazing man. And there are, I mean, the central character, again, was a teenage girl, and so therefore it often gets put on this YA table, the young adult table. But actually, it's just a profound, brilliant set of novels. And I think time and time again, I would go back to those books as being my favourite, I think.
You're interesting as an individual. I don't know you very well at all. I know you like the majority of people listening to this programme, which is I hear your voice. I listen to you on the radio. I just find it interesting that you were the son of two teachers. You said you moved around a lot as a kid, and you remember being constantly on the outside of everything,
yeah,
and never fitting in. And that's the bit that I thought, for someone that fits in and is so comfortable with an audience, knows how to fit in with a listenership, how did you not fit in at school? What was that about?
I think I've thought about this quite a lot. I mean, I only realised that specifically the books I wrote for younger readers, the Itch series, was about a kid, 14-year-old kid who didn't fit in. He was a Londoner. He'd moved to Cornwall, and he was only interested in science, and none of his friends did. And it was the aforementioned son, who you mentioned, Ben, who said, "Dad, this isn't about anyone other than you." And I hadn't really thought about that until he mentioned it, and I then thought, "Yeah, you're probably right." But I wonder how many people listening now will go, "Well, you know what? I don't quite fit in." I think most of us don't quite fit in. We all have to pretend that we do, whether we're at work or whether we're with our friends down the pub. And there'll be a few people that we really do click with, but the rest of it, I think, you know, we pretend. And so, well, you know, so I certainly do. So I think it's to do, I mean, and I think from my point of view, it was certainly to do, we moved around a lot when I was growing up. I moved a lot to different schools. And so you constantly feel on the outside. But I think a lot of people constantly feel on the outside.
Do you still feel on the outside?
Less so, I think. I certainly feel, I mean, from a work point of view, so I'm sitting in the BBC here in London. Radio 2 is the most at home I've ever felt at a radio station, bar none. It's a wonderful place to be. It's very comfortable. It's full of people who tend to be comfortable in their own skins. Very little jostling for position. You know, at Radio 1, everybody wanted someone else's job.
A lot of backstabbing at Radio 1.
Well, it was kind of, it was like dinosaurs running around, crashing heads with each other, you know, yeah. And they had everyone had vast audiences. You know, if you had an audience of 11 or 12 million or something, imagine what that does to your soul. So but everyone is sort of more at ease. So I think the answer to your question, Stephen, is as you get old, maybe you feel more at ease with where you are, I think.
Well, that's, yeah, and you certainly feel at ease, as you said, in Radio 2. I was saying on the radio a number of weeks ago that I envy people who have a faith. I've tried to believe in God and can't. And you've been a practicing Christian for many years, right?
Yes.
Does that bring you a comfort in life?
I would describe myself as an Anglican rationalist.
What does that mean?
I have no idea. But it sort of gets me off the hook a lot of the time.
Does that give you an ease in life? Does that give you a comfort in your own skin that you've got that kind of, I guess, pillar that like me doesn't have?
No, I don't. I think everyone is different. I feel on the outside of that as well. I mean, you will ask that question to 100 different people and you'll get 100 different answers. But I feel outside of most of those conversations. And when I usually turn off pause for thought, and I usually turn off thought for the day.
Okay. So it's something very personal to you that essentially you don't want to talk about.
Well, I think there was a point, I'm just referring to the last character that I was talking about. It's Itchingham Loft, and I'm not doing...
I get that.
I'm using this as a device, but I think it's true. There's a section in the last book when Itch, who is this science kid, he looks at the periodic table, which is on his wall, and he gazes at it, and his life is in turmoil. And he looks at this extraordinary, iconic image, and he gets his calmness from that, knowing that everything is in order and everything has a place. And I think you can get as much wisdom from that as you can from anywhere else. I think I'm a rationalist first and foremost, but the Anglican Church is my tribe. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What do you do for your downtime, by the way? Finally. You know, do you fish?
Do
you go naked scuba diving with Kermode? What do you do?
Yes, I do that. I think the problem is if you start to write stories, that it consumes every single available space in your head, so that apart from doing six radio shows a week, something I do, you know. But
listen,
you know,
I do nine.
Yeah, only you do nine. Okay, I bow before your
superior
numbers.
That's a sign of
numbers.
Me not getting paid as much as you, but that's okay.
Okay, well, apart from doing six, not as good as nine radio shows, I write and I have a family and I read, because the Radio 2 Book Club takes up an awful lot of my time. So writing, reading, no arithmetic, being on the radio and following football. And that's about all I can offer, really.
I want to talk to you more, but I can't. They're shouting at me in the air.
Well, who's in charge?
Oh, well, exactly.
Who's in charge?
Exactly. You both know, we both know who's in charge. We are. We'll just get to know.
Throw a tantrum.
Yeah, I will. Simon, lovely to talk to you. The book, the fourth book, it's called Blame. And it's a good read. Thank you, Simon. Morning to you.